If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Today's episode of Pixel Sift is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/pixelsift. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for you on your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle, or your MP3 player. Hello and welcome to episode 58 of Pixel Sift, and it's actually episode 2 of Pixel Sift Mitchless Edition. Today I'm joined in the studio by Scott and James. We've pulled him away from the keyboard and put him in front of a camera and a microphone this time. Say hello.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Well, good. Yeah. Good instructions there. Yep. And we're also joined by via the wanderers of the internet by Ellen Urich of Blowfish Studios. And Ellen, you're going to tell us a little bit about your game and your experience working in the gaming industry.
Yeah, nice to meet you guys. Well, meet you online again.
And we will continue this conversation throughout the episode. But we've got a few other topics to talk about, haven't we?
Yeah, sure. Loot boxes, trash or treasure? We open up this topic with a legendary drop probability of 1 in 7.
We'll also be looking at why Crytek is back in the news again for all the wrong reasons.
It all sounds very exciting. Shall we jump in?
We shall.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Pixel Sift, or you might be watching Pixel Sift on Twitch. Pixel Sift.
So this week, developer Crytek hit news headlines yet again for failing to pay their staff. This is the second time, with the last time being in 2014, that the developer has reached the news for unpaid wages. The independent developer of games such as the original Far Cry and Xbox exclusive Rise is once again faced with poor management and mass walkouts. And this will be our first topic for today. This all came about in the news earlier this week when a Reddit post appeared, crying for help and advice from the community. And that's spurred on a bunch of other stories that have popped up everywhere, and it's big hot news again this week.
It's really interesting. I think a lot of the commentary around this particular story is that this seems to be sort of one person's perspective at the moment, and there's kind of a bit difficult to verify exactly what is going on here. You know, a big development studio like Crytek, which involves, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people, will often do sort of subcontracting work to other smaller groups. And, you know, there's some sort of discussion about what the actual contracting terms of this particular agreement is. Do they get paid at the end of the job, or do they get paid as they're going through? So it's sort of something to think about. And I guess having this attached to a studio like Crytek, which a lot of people would know, Crysis used to be the one that everyone would chuck on their computer when they bought a new machine to test it all out. It does sort of prompt some interesting discussions, I think.
Well, I don't know about the contracts per se, but I know that when this first came up as an original problem in about mid-2014, there was all these kind of rules that the employees had to abide by, like that they couldn't discuss their salaries via emails and all this sort of stuff to avoid, I guess, a kind of paper trail, I get. And I guess about information leaking via that kind of trail. So that kind of tactic leads to not very well-rounded contract. I mean, that's just assumptions, and I probably shouldn't make them, to be fair.
Ellen, you've worked for a number of game development studios. If someone sort of said to you, don't talk about your contracts and all that sort of stuff, how would that sort of make you feel? Or is that common practice?
That's actually been common practice in the places that I've worked at. it seems to be like, I don't particularly agree with it. And I have worked at, you know, obviously non-games companies as well, where it was very open about who, like, who was earning what. And that was simply because, for example, all of the casual staff members were paid in the exact same rate, or it was relative to your age, or, you know, it was really, really clear and obvious who was being paid what and why. Whereas in the games companies that I've worked for, it's not always been as transparent why someone should be paid a certain way, what makes someone a junior versus a mid-level versus a senior versus a manager. And, you know, why is one person, why should one person be paid more than someone else? That doesn't mean that individuals can't discuss what they're on in their own time. And often when that has come up, you know, it sort of comes out that people are being paid more or less what they're expecting. There's no huge discrepancy. But that clause certainly has popped up in a few contracts that I've seen.
I guess it's really interesting as people kind of go through these sort of things. There is usually a sort of a difference in, I guess, position of power almost, in that if you're a junior person working in a studio and this is the first one that you've ever worked in and you don't have that years of experience to sort of draw on, how do you kind of value what your work is worth? And if you can't directly compare it with other people, I guess you could do it off the books at the tea room, you know, make yourself a cup of coffee or whatever. But, you know, how do people kind of value their work?
I suppose that it's the same. I guess you'd get this kind of problem in a lot of other artistic industries as well. And it's like, a lot of the young people would be exploited in that kind of way. And they've got to kind of figure out how much, you know, how they're willing to push and how much they're willing to put up with, I guess. Because they're there for a bit of a love and a passion, being developers, especially indie developers, you know, and it's like, how much of it are you willing to do for love, and how long does that love stretch?
Very good question.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's true as well of a lot of contracting, even if it's not in games or not necessarily creative industry, it becomes very hard to gauge how much your services are worth, especially if there's elements of not feeling, I don't want to say imposter syndrome, but not feeling like maybe you know as much as someone else, like you feel like you're riding on just talent, or you aren't very experienced, so therefore you shouldn't be charging as much as someone else who's got, you know, 10 years on you, even though they may not be as good at what you do as you are. It becomes very, very hard, and it's hard as well going from, say, full-time work to contracting, knowing how much to be charging per hour, because it is quite different. But I mean, in terms of positions within the games industry, there are things like Glassdoor, which allow you to go and sort of salary check. There used to be the game developers, the Games Career Guide salary survey every year as well. But I sort of noticed, I don't know, maybe it's come up since I last checked, but it sort of seemed to drop off the last couple of years. I don't know if they've been really focusing on that as much, but that used to be a really good way of looking at what does someone with my level of experience in my industry get on average, even though that was usually in America, which doesn't necessarily apply anywhere else. It gave you an idea of what the range was, at least relative to other disciplines as well.
In Australia, at least, it seems like there's been a bit of a, at least in the sort of last 5-10 years or so, a sort of a transformation of what the Australian game development industry looks like. We previously had a bunch of smaller branches of big studios from around the world, and some of those have disappeared now, and people have gone off and moved into sort of middle to getting bigger studios as well. Do you think people are sort of, it's hard to sort of determine what it is if people are out there on their own back creating their own studios, and this sort of move to an indie perspective is more people kind of do it for the love of it?
I think there is a lack overall in sort of government support for incentives for to sort of really strengthen and encourage the industry in Australia. We've seen that in Victoria there's a lot more incentives than the other states get, and it's really grown and been supportive there. Outside of that, I'd love to be able to reclaim the word amateur in the way that, you know, in theatre, I've got a theatre background, and, you know, talking about amateur theatre, the word amateur comes from the word to love. So it's really not about being, you know, a bad person that can't do it professionally. It's someone that does it for love, regardless of whether they're being paid or not. And I think there is a lot of that love behind what people do as indies, because there is just that drive to create and that drive to contribute.
It's definitely a very interesting topic, and one that is always going to come up as these sort of stories come out. We'll hopefully find out a bit more information about what the backstory behind this particular Crytek sort of issue is. We'll be putting links up to that on our website, but right now let's jump into our next topic. You're listening to Pixel Sift. We are still joined by Ellen from Sydney's Blowfish Studios. Ellen, you're a producer and a game designer. Now, most people probably know what a game designer is, but what does a producer do in terms of making a game?
So I've done a bit of production in, this is the third company that I've been at where I've done production, and it does really depend on the kind of work that, like the kind of, the size of the company, the number of projects running. I've worked in, you know, one company that had, I think, about 70 people working on one project versus another company that was the studio itself, which was a branch of a larger company, was about 90 people, but we were in teams of variable numbers that went up to, say, 30. And then here at Blowfish, we've got, I think about 16, 17 people now. And we're currently on, I think we figured out about 7 projects at the same time. So what that means for a producer is quite different depending on what the requirements are for the game. But overall, the producer's job is essentially to let other people do their jobs unhampered. That would be the best definition I could come up with. So that could be anything from scheduling of tasks, gathering requirements. It could be ordering overtime food, unfortunately. It could be just making sure that everyone's okay, not necessarily in a like an HR perspective, but you could be that first person that people want to talk to about any issues that they've got with, anything that's just getting in the way of their work. It's sort of your responsibility to jump in there and try and clear away those impediments.
Is it? I guess when you're sort of defining the role as being quite broad, and there are sort of a variety of different hats that you need to wear when you're doing that, is it difficult not to take on too much?
Very, very. And I think I was talking to another producer about this recently. There's this kind of tendency to want to, like, you'll feel like you're never doing quite enough. And often as a producer, if you're not taking on another role, like I'm doing game design as well, if you're not taking on another role, you can kind of end up feeling like you've spent all of this time here, but there's nothing that you can point to and say, I did that. And it can be quite demoralizing when you feel like I'm working on these games and I helped get this game out, but what did I do that was special? I did nothing unique. Did I actually bring anything to this? So that can sort of push you to do one of two things, neither of which are very good, but in different ways they're bad. One is that you can basically overwork and overextend yourself and try and push too hard and, you know, almost burn out from being in first and out last all the time. And the other thing that you can do is you can grow really apathetic. And I've seen producers that basically just busy work all the time, but do nothing and leave, you know, bang on time and don't arrive, you know, any earlier or anything like that. They're basically doing nothing. They're just there because they're just cruising kind of thing. And that's, to me, that's more detrimental to the team, whereas kind of overworking is more detrimental to the individual and probably beneficial to the team, weirdly enough.
So what do you do to stop yourself from taking on too much or not become too apathetic about the things that you have to do in your day-to-day?
I think ultimately it's, well, there's two. Those are two sort of different problems to get yourself out of. So for a situation where you are trying to push yourself and do too much, it's really important to talk to and express your concerns, your stresses, your fears. I mean, I used to kind of think, I'm not going to tell anyone that I'm stressed about this. I'm not going to let anyone know that, you know, it's the team shouldn't have to deal with my stress over, you know, the client or the, you know, the demands that are being made. I need to look, you know, I need to protect them from any of that stress and kind of weather it myself. But I ended up finding out that some of the developers that I worked with assumed that I wasn't stressed and I was just blasé about it, and that I was just dumping things on them and not trying to protect them. And they had no idea what I was doing to try to protect them. And that undermined what I was striving to do, which was to have kind of a team mentality and a lot of, you know, shared morale. So I learned that once I do share some of that, that actually helped a lot more. And it also meant that they could then reflect back that they appreciated what I was doing to help them, and that then fed the need to feel like I was actually doing and I was actually helping. I was actually getting that feedback. To avoid getting apathetic, I think it's just one of those things that it's like you get too far into the other camp. You stress yourself too much, and then ultimately you just go, is this even worth it? And you, like, I don't know how to get out of that. I haven't got into it, and I hope I never get into, yeah, I hope I never, ever get apathetic, because that's just a bad way to be. But anytime I have nearly gotten like that, I mean, ultimately I did the same thing. I shared and I said, you know, look, I'm stressed about this. I'm worried about this. I either talk to my boss or colleagues or, you know, even people on a different project and just say, you know, it's just overwhelming. And just to have that vent, because even though you are there to make sure that there are no impediments, nothing blocking, nothing getting in the way of them doing their work, it's that whole thing of like, how can you care for anyone else if you're not caring for yourself? So you've got to make sure that you're not getting overwhelmed either.
So you're working on a number of projects at the moment, and obviously it's keeping that balance between working hard but also not working yourself to the bone. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you're working on at the moment? We had a chance to play some of the games, namely Siegecraft Commander at PAX. And for Scott, it was actually his one of his first...
it was my first proper VR experience, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how that game came about.
I think the game kind of came about with... it was a combination between... I wasn't there when it started, by the way, but so I'll just, you know, full disclaimer, I wasn't there when it started up. But it was a combination between someone showing this old game that they'd played called Moonbase Commander, which had a very similar mechanic, and also continuing the Siegecraft IP, which is Blowfish's own IP. So it was a combination of those two inspirations, really.
Yeah. So I did get to play the Siegecraft Commander in the platform condition as well as the VR. It was quite amazing to see the difference between the games, I guess, and the leaps and bounds that it goes in, the creativity and control that you have in the VR environment. Is it really nice to be able to... I know that you didn't specifically work with the Siegecraft Commander, like you said, but for future stuff, what is it like comparing... you know, the world of platform and console, let's say, to VR, as far as on a design level anyway?
So in terms of design, we actually had this really sort of lucky experience where, because Siegecraft Commander does have that top-down tabletop feel already, when we put it in, you know, when we just tried to, you know, let's try it in VR, we kind of, you know, why not? Like, we're trying out VR, we're doing different experiences, we're making more kind of, you know, we do a lot of contract work, and so we've tried to make a few little bits and pieces of experiences and demos that are more kind of what you would expect of VR experiences, more first person, you know, moving around as though you're a person in the scene. And so this, we just went, oh, well, let's just see what happens if, you know, you just bang it in VR, and let's just jump in and see what happens. And this strange thing happened where just everyone has that same experience where once they figure out how they can move around, they basically just like zoom themselves right in and they start looking around. And it reminded me of the experience that I had when I first started playing. Like, I didn't do a lot of tabletop stuff, but like I went to Tactics in like the Perth, like in London Court, And I remember like going down there and just looking at like the tabletop layout that they had and everything that they'd constructed. And I was just like, I want to stand in this little world. Like I want to squat down and I want to look at the tiny little trees and the water that's been painted in so lovingly. Like I just want to get right in there and look at it all because it's tiny and it's amazing.
Exactly.
And that's the exact same experience.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I felt it like it was a mixture between exactly that, seeing those big scale, beautiful things that you used to always see in toy shops and what games shop and whatever, mixed with like the kind of real life games that you'd see in, say, Star Wars or whatever, with their kind of like interactive digital chess.
Did you let the Wookiee win?
You got to let the Wookiee win. But yeah, it was exactly like that. It's amazing. The ability to kind of be playing a board game, but in VR, so you have full control over everything that you would in, say, like an AOE world or whatever.
Now, Ellen, can you play? Yeah. Obviously, it is a multiplayer game. We played against each other on the PAX floor. But for the virtual reality experience, is it possible to play against someone and see them on the other side of the battlefield controlling the troops as well?
So you can play against people in VR. So say going from PC to VR or console to VR, especially if you're using whatever the Steam one is, the Vive.
Vive,
I think. Oh, confused myself. Because that is through Steam, it counts as essentially PC as a game. So we do cross-play from either of the consoles to PC, but not console to console. So in doing that, you can play console to VR or PC to VR. You don't actually see the other person per se, but you can... You know, you can go in and play together.
Awesome. Ellen, I've got one final question for you. Do you think that any project can be translated to virtual reality, or is it something that is sort of inherent about the sort of games that, I guess, Siegecraft Commander is, or can you kind of make each game work there?
I think that's really a case-by-case basis. I mean, we've seen a lot of first-person shooter type games and first-person games and puzzle games and adventure games that use and utilize that first-person experience. And that's traditionally what people think of in virtual reality, that first-person experience. We found that the kind of God mode view worked really, really well. But that's the first time, you know, we haven't heard of anyone else trying a game like that aside from us. I mean, I'm not saying that no one is, probably someone is, because that's just the way the universe works. But we were very pleasantly surprised, and it was kind of this feeling of like, of course this would work. So I think it's just a matter of anyone that's working in Unity should just, you know, go like, well, I'm going to try and make this work. I think, you know, you do need a third person world, a 3D world. 2D might be a little bit challenging for VR, but I'd love to see someone...
Maybe
play around with that.
Fez could be an example that would work well in VR with a hybrid mode between the two of them. Ellen, it's your game is going to be coming out in sort of this on the 17th of January, in a couple of weeks really. Now we're almost into 2017, so
it's only a month away.
Very soon. If people want to find out more information about it, where's the best place for them to head to?
Where's the best place? They can probably follow us on Twitter is probably the best. We do keep sending out little tweets and updates about it. So that's at Blowfish Studios.
And you've got a website as well, blowfishstudios.com, with all of your games listed on there.
Yes. You can find us generally on Steam and stores and things like that as well. So
and
just, I mean, just Google us. We'll come up number one. So.
Of course, we'll be putting links into the show notes of this particular episode. Right now, though, let's jump into our next topic.
Let's do it.
Watch episodes, let's plays, and more at youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
So we're all aware of those cargo crates, loot boxes, ultimate chests, or whatever your game devs want to call them. After a steady pour of public disheartenment, China is taking a stand and will require developers to display the probability of item drops online. Is this a step in the right direction, or China's just gone too far?
Now, Mitch, who's not here but is watching online, is a big fan of the loot box model. You know, we don't let him near the casino because obviously he likes that sort of gambling model. Ellen, I'm interested to hear what you think about this model of having a sort of a random drop where people can get the promise of a good item but are up against the gods of random number generators.
Well, I think there's a few things going on with sort of, you know, like loot crates and things like that. Like, I don't think it's necessarily a gamble thing. I think it's the thrill of the unknown. And I think it is kind of sinking money into an experience, and that experience is the element of surprise, the element of unknown. There is a chance that you'll lose, but like whether you win or lose, you've probably paid that real world money one way or the other. So I think people do love it. And I remember, like, I think it could have been the first Mario Brothers or something like that. There was like this very clear, obvious like slot machine thing that happened. But because you weren't paying real money, I think it was somehow considered okay, or like, I don't know. But in terms of like, I've worked on games where we've had responses back from players that say this particular, you know, drop is rigged. There's no way you can win. You only get the bad prizes. You'll never get anything out of it. Once it was a bug, and it was true, it was rigged accidentally as part of a bug.
How do you communicate that to also, your players? Do you own up to it and say, yes, there was a bug, and we go from there? Or, you know, you guys, I guess the developer is holding all the cards in this particular situation. Can you just keep it quiet?
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember what we ultimately decided to do, but I think, like, as the developers on the team, I think we were like, you know what, I'm happy to be transparent about this because it was a bug, you know. Sorry, everyone. Let's, you know, what can we do to make it up to you? And that was very much the stance that we liked taking. What ended up happening, I'm not 100% sure. But at the same time, there were many times where it wasn't rigged. There wasn't a bug. The odds were just very, very low to get, you know, the ultimate drop. And that's just how that sort of rolls. That's the way it works, unfortunately. And it depends on the game, and it depends on, like, talking about freemium games, you end up talking about whales and minnows and dolphins and different types of players, and you kind of talk about time-rich versus money-rich players. And money-rich players are the ones that are quite happy to skip waiting times using real money. And there's the players that are time-rich, and they're quite happy to wait for tomorrow for their three crates to refill, or, you know, to play and grind until they get it. So it's all about kind of risk versus reward and that experience, that excitement. Do I think it's a good idea to expose the odds? You know, I'd be very interested to find out whether exposing the odds affected the number of people that continue to pay for, you know, the loot crates.
When you think about it, odds are often given in normal lotteries. You can go buy yourself a lotto ticket and they'll give you the odds.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop people going down to the local newsagent and picking one up.
And this applies to China as well. Although, like, you know, gambling is illegal in most of China, they do have a state lottery of sorts. And, you know, there is pockets that it's plenty legal in. Mm. But I think this is a move by China that won't really translate to the Western world too much, because I feel like this is a push from their, like, anti-gambling background.
And there are a lot of adaptions that are made for games as they make their transition into China. And whether or not this is going to have an impact on, Western studios or studios from the other parts of the world moving their games into that. I mean, Overwatch and Hearthstone. And Hearthstone is a really good example, because if you think about it, the collectible card game model is effectively the loot box model. And you have that sort of blind box, and you open up as many booster packs or whatever you want to call them in order to get the card you want. But there is that kind of, you know, risk reward, and whether or not that is worth it for you.
Look, I hate loot boxes in all of the games that they're available in. Like, the only game that they're kind of suitable and don't kind of completely annoy me is the Battlefield games because you get some kind of value. I get some kind of value from them. I don't really like skins and all that stuff, but I do think that the obsession with the Overwatch loot boxes is great, and it's a real testament to kind of Blizzard's artwork and the way that they've developed that as a big fan following.
Look, there could be economics degrees that are done just on the way that Blizzard models its player behavior and makes good money out of the way that they do this.
But
and
another reason, sorry, I'll just say that another reason why this loot idea is in the news this week is because a Blizzard gifted Reddit user Kleptic 500 loot boxes for some troubles he was having with losing some loot boxes over the summer game period.
Is it fun, though, if you get 500 for free?
It took him 2 hours to open them all, apparently. And he got back all the ones that he lost, but also he gained like 15,000 in-game currency as well, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, so, of course it's fun to open everything you lost. It's like someone stealing all of your audio gear.
I find the Overwatch loot boxes the most disappointing of all of them, and that's why I don't like them. I just leave them. I've got them all masked up. I just don't get it.
Mitch is a big fan. He's saying on the Twitch chat that he's the time-rich versus money-rich is a great concept. Regarding the different types of players out there. And he also says that he loves different skins.
Yes. And I'm sure it's just me. I know that's me not liking skins. I know there's a huge community. And same with CSGO, there's a huge community of people. I mean, look at the CS Lotto in exactly. General. It wouldn't exist without people's love for skins.
And there's a whole just secondary, not this guy. Secondary market involved.
Mitch had a lot to say on this topic, actually. He'd love to be in on this. He's Mitch, very pro loot box.
Mitch, never go on holidays again. look, speaking of holidays, we're going to have to take a very slight break, and this is the end of episode 58. Ellen, thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Pixel Sift. Very interesting to hear about your experiences, and just keep an eye out for Siegecraft Commander early next year on the 17th of January.
Keep it on VR.
Yeah, have a go on that if you get a chance to do that. Yeah. Very exciting. We have a website. That website is www.pixelsift.com.au. Scott, we have also these things called social media.
Yeah, many of them. We have facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
And James, we have old episodes, do we not? We have... Unlike Mitch, we've got a good grasp on the 50-something episodes we've had previous to this one.
Yeah, we've had significantly more than 28, and you can check them out on our website to stream episodes, subscribe as a podcast, either on iTunes, Pocket Cast, or using the RSS link on your page. Also, Google Play, if you're not in the Oceanic region.
Yeah. Or anywhere, if you're in the United States, you can listen to it. Presumably you are. Now, who knows?
You could be anywhere.
Uh-huh. I can't listen to it. Thank you very much. We will be back in early January, around the 12th of January. So have a good break over the sort of summer for us, winter for other people around the world. Have a good time. We will see you soon. Just
perhaps you should sift some of your own pixels while you're away.
Exactly.
Peace out.
See you next time.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.